Thank you for tuning in to the Negative Positives Podcast. I've got a great guest for you this evening. I'd like to introduce everyone to Jess Kosmak. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. This is an honor to be on this illustrious podcast.
Hey, well, you know, we haven't had you on the podcast before, so having you now to me is like, it's, you're a good get. I'm really happy we got you. So I think probably a lot of people in our community know you or follow you or, you know, have some interaction with you, but yeah, I'm sure they'll be happy to hear you talk. So
cool.
But since, for the people who don't know you at all, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe what you're trying to do with your photography or, you know, whatever you feel like.
Yeah, for sure. So my name's Jess Kosmak. I live in Toronto, Ontario. I lived here all my life. And I'm a photographer. I'm a writer. I work in corporate communications. I do a lot of different creative things as well. Nice. And have a family here, two kids and my dog and my husband. And yeah, photography is always been a part of my life, always been a passion of mine. I grew up in the film only era of photography. So I've come back to shooting film in the last 5-6 years, probably.
Okay.
So
nice.
It's not an unusual story of picking up the camera my grandfather had given me back in the early 2000s that I sort of shelved at the time because digital was just coming in and
yeah.
I already had some film cameras and I was kind of, you know, leaning into the digital stuff. And I did that for a long time. And then, just decided to actually pick that Pentax Spotmatic up, and which I know Mike will be happy to hear.
Good working person's camera for sure.
Yeah. And I love it. Still one of my favorites. I love that camera so much. And I had a weird stockpile of old expired films that, of course, I wasn't keeping in any sort of good storage environment. and then just dove in, you know, little by little, figuring out where I could get new film, figuring out, you know, who was still shooting it, who was interested in it. And yeah, here I am. And now I still shoot digital sometimes, but I primarily shoot film.
Even for work? Because you say are you a working photographer? Did I miss that?
No, I do some family shoots and stuff like that. And I am easing my way into bringing film to those shoots. And like a lot of people, I think, I'm sort of afraid to pull the trigger fully. But then, of course, every time I develop the pictures from those shoots, my favorite shots are the ones I took on film. So we'll see.
There is the two sides of your brain pulling at you at the same time, right? I can't take a chance, but I want to. I'm not professional at all. No one's ever paid me for my photography yet, but I love it very much. And so it's a little easier for me being a passion project because I can always be like, well, I screwed up. I mean, I don't want to. I don't want to say that. I don't feel like that's a good out. But when you're actually contracted by somebody, I can imagine that the stress level failure is not an option, right?
I don't do a ton. I'm kind of at the stage where I have a few families and clients that come back to me every year. And if the right word of mouth situation happens, then I'll do that. But a lot of my photography is just for me documenting my life and my family and my kids. And I also love experimenting, and it's not always the easiest time to do that if you're being paid to do it, but.
Well, yeah, because you don't know if the person who is going to receive that it was in the experimental mood, do you? And sometimes they are, right? Sometimes people are, but then sometimes they're not. So I don't know. You know way more about this than I do. I adore the idea of portraits and families and people, I think, are the highest subject for photography, right? But man, I'm so bad at it. I'm so bad at it. I want to be so good at it, and I'm just not. So I really adore people like you that can do that. That's really a great skill.
Oh,
so,
thanks. Yeah, it's fun. I like it.
So that's super cool. All right. Well, we're glad to have you. That's great to know, you know, that you do both. And it came back. And actually, about your kids, you mentioned your kids. I remember seeing a picture the other day, or a couple of pictures you put up of your kids on their last day of school. And they look like they got their butts kicked. I mean, especially your daughter. And there was a one where she was just kind of like sitting there and just like, I mean, she looked worn out. Like,
yeah
that's...
Come on, Mike, the end of a school year, it's tiring.
It is.
It was really hot, and we normally do that photo in the morning, and we didn't because we were not organized. And so I made them do it at the end of the day, and I think those words, made them do it, are why their faces are like that. And I've just, it's harder as they get older. It's not their favorite thing to be the subject of my... Yeah. Photos when I ask them. They don't mind if I'm capturing them doing whatever they're doing, but setting up shots and getting them to be my models is harder and harder. And so I'm just leaning into their natural expressions,
yeah,
which I kind of love in a way.
Those pictures were great. They really were, you know, and it makes sense too, right? If you normally do it in the morning, it's cool or still kind of energetic, but like toward the end of the day, I mean, I think most of us, when we get home from work, you know, be not in a mood for something like that.
I mean, I didn't even want to do it, but I knew that it's part of I've been doing it since they started, you know, like preschool. And so... I always do a first and last day, and I have to keep that going because we've been doing it, 10 plus years now. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
And that'll be so good when, you know, when they're grown and all that, that'll be definitely worth the effort.
Yeah. I think so.
And those real ones would probably be some of the best. So that's awesome.
Exactly. That's
so cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, one of the other things I was excited to have you on the podcast about too is that we could talk about Formula One. And because there's not a whole lot of people that I know that I can talk to about this. There's some guys at work that are semi-interested, but usually they just read whatever somebody told them, you know. But that was one of the bonuses I found out about you. I think we ended up connecting on Instagram, and then you posted you were going to Monaco and was like, holy cow, that's awesome. And so when I'm talking, it's like, this is great. And for the audience, normally we wouldn't spend too much time talking about Formula One. However, since Drive to Survive happened in 2020, right? Wasn't that the year it came out? I think they filmed it in 19 and it came out in 20, or was I back?
No, it's earlier. I think it's earlier because I think...
Oh, like maybe it came out in 19?
One year earlier, maybe. Yeah.
Oh, like they filmed it in 18. It came out in 19?
I think so. I feel like I had a lot of seasons to binge.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but that series, for good, bad, whatever you want to call it, that has really helped pick up Formula One in the United States, right? So we almost have too many races, right? There's going to be a race in Vegas this year, and there was one in Miami. There'll be one in Austin. And then you got the Andretti team maybe getting in there. So let me ask you this. I don't want to just keep hitting you with rapid fire questions, but how did you discover Formula One?
So Formula One, I do not pretend to be a lifelong fan. I am also a Drive to Survive era fan, but that's fine. I own that. But I will say that by osmosis, I am also a fan because my husband has been watching it since he was a kid, and every single Saturday, the TV's on for qualifying. Every Sunday, it's on for the race. He bless him, has talked to me about it for years, and I listen, but I didn't always know what he was talking about, or I didn't watch the races with him, so I wasn't super into it. But he had a milestone birthday this year, and we'd been planning probably for a couple of years that we wanted to go to Monaco to the Grand Prix. Awesome. He's never, despite being a super fan, has never been to a race. And so
oh, wow.
we decided to start with the biggest and the most top race.
Yeah.
Monaco's iconic. It's just, yeah, city races are so cool. And so we plan, yeah, we've been planning this for a couple of years that that's what we were going to do. And then we bought our tickets almost a year ahead of time when they came on sale. And that was my cue to, for me, I knew I'd enjoy the experience a lot more if I knew what I was watching more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I put in the work and I watched all five seasons or whatever it is of Drive to Survive and would come home. I would watch them on my commute to work and I'd come home at the end of the day and I'd have to debrief with Mark about what happened that day. And so I think he saw me getting more and more and more into it. And then going to Monaco just sealed the deal.
Oh man.
So yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. That's cool. Well, from my point, I remember how I got into Formula One. It was not on TV, you know, in the 80s. And I mean, for a lot of time, I didn't even know it existed. I grew up in Michigan. There was, and what kills me later finding out that there was, they raced in Detroit. I mean, there's been races in Detroit, but Formula One was in Detroit from like 84 to 88 or something like that.
Crazy.
And from where I grew up,
yeah,
it was only about 20 minutes away, you know. It's so weird, you know, because when it's like, it's that weird thing, like when you're a kid, wherever you go, your world seems so big. But then when you move away and you come back and you're like, wait, it's like when you go back to your elementary school, it seems so small.
Yes.
Right. Compared to when you were there, it seemed huge.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I was just like, but I couldn't believe that Ayrton Senna was racing. He was like 20 minutes away from me. You know what I mean? I could have seen the guy.
Nuts.
But I discovered Formula One the funny way in back when maybe it was Save on Drugs, back when the drugstore was a big thing. Yeah. And they had like the magazines was the half of the aisle, like the whole aisle was all magazines. Yeah. And I was in Car and Driver. Yeah, Car and Driver. Nigel Roebuck used to write a story about the races, but the lag was so bad. I feel like the first time, I picked up that I was flipping through the magazine, and it had the two McLaren Hondas with Senna and Prost, and the red and white cars, and Senna's yellow helmet, and the Marlboro, and the red and white, and you know, then you start reading it, find out what a crazy guy Ron Dennis is, and you know, and they like the whole thing was just like, oh, this is so awesome. How am I gonna see this? So like for a year, you know, I was like just going crazy waiting for the next issue of the magazine to come out, and like, yeah, is there a race in there? There's not. Oh man, you know, because they were like 4 or 5 months behind, right? So
yeah.
But then I remember 91 was the first race I got to watch. It was in Phoenix, and pretty much I've seen at least a little bit of every race since then. I've seen most of them. I don't think I've missed any race completely, and there's been some great times. There's been some, I mean, I was watching the race when Ayrton Senna passed. That was pretty sad. I mean, that was a bad weekend. I mean, Roland Ratzenberger got killed, and then he got it. So yeah, it's crazy stuff. But yeah, so I did watch. I have to admit, I only watched one season of Drive to Survive. I watched the first one, and okay, it was a good season. I really liked that because, you know, you watch the races and you see the press conferences, but you don't really see Karen Horner Christian Horner. He's a Karen. He is so a Karen. And who was the guy from Renault? I forget his name, the boss. And, you know, and they were like sniping at each other behind.
Oh, Cyril. Right. I loved him.
Yeah. Yes.
So, yeah.
So it's that. But then the next year I had heard before the reviews said that they were trying to whip up some drama between Lando Norris and like Max Verstappen or something, turn it into some sort of a, I don't know what drama.
Yeah. Thing. There was like, drama. They were making drama between Lando and Daniel. Which
oh,
was,
really?
Yeah.
No, that's. And Lando is that guy is so cool. I can't picture him. I mean, of course, it's not like we live with him, but that guy seems so, he's always happy. He's like Lewis, you know what I mean? Like he's always got a good attitude and takes it on the chin, but he's like, anyhow. So I didn't watch any more after that. So I don't mean to be the cranky old guy, but I watched that stuff, but I kind of did. So,
I mean, I think it's helped me get into it because of the personalities. For me, it really helps know them more, and I have if I've never really paid attention before, I need something to kind of hang on to.
And no, that's a really good point. That's really good.
Yeah. Yep. So, and I feel like it's interesting now because I'm watching the races every weekend and I'm thinking, and even the stuff that happens in between races during the week, I'm thinking, I wonder what they're going to pull from what's happening for the next season. And because you know, there's stuff that you see that's going to be on it. And then, and you also, when you're at a race, you see the cameras and the mics following everybody around all the time. And so you don't know who's Netflix and who's just press and who's, you know, their own PR people. But yeah, it's really, it's a spectacle. That's for sure right now.
Well, imagine. I've been to two races myself, both at Indianapolis. Once was in 2000, the first year. And then the second time was in 2006. It was the year after Tiregate. I don't know if you ever heard about that, when the Michelin tires wouldn't work. So they used to have a tire war where there was Bridgestone and Michelin.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine? I can't even imagine. I'm not asking how much it cost you to get to Monaco and to buy the tickets and to your hotel and all that stuff. But can you imagine showing up and then like three teams race? You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's one is the top end and the other two are the bottom feeders. Like it would just, I was angry and all I was doing was watching it on TV and I'm like, what?
I was getting worried because there were so many French strikes happening because of the just political climate that was going on. And so there was a lot of threatening strikes that, even though Monaco's not technically in France, but they talked about, you know, maybe pulling the power grid to the race, and nothing happened. It was fine. It was fine.
Well, you can imagine, right, the amount of viewership in over the course of the world. I mean, if you want to get some attention. I mean, you remember, it was a long time ago, but there have been times when, like, naked dudes would run out on the track at Silverstone or whatever. Right. You know, I think, I don't know what it is about that British race. I don't know if they were British people or what, but that place just seems to bring the nuts out.
I'm just surprised that, like, streaking is still a thing. Like, it still happens at all sporting events. It's an old school interrupter. I kind of like it.
But I think the universal constant is the people that do the streaking really shouldn't be streaking. No. Not that you get a good look or anything, or we even want to, but still. I think oh, man. So let me go back one. No, there's no point in going back. I was going to say, we talked about Tiregate and I didn't really explain what happened, but I'll leave it alone because we might So not only did you go to Monaco though, but then you shot film in Monaco. So, sure. I mean, and so I want you to tell me about it, but there's one thing I want to say about Monaco that I think is the coolest thing compared to any other racetrack that exists, is that if you watch the early black and whites from the first races there, it's the same. I mean, okay, it's not exactly the same, but the roads essentially are the same. You know, most of it is that there's more barriers now, you know, but in the beginning, when those cars that had the skinny tires and the guys basically from their waist up, and you had those big steering wheels. Yeah. And, I mean, back when driving was dangerous and sex was safe, right? But back then the track's the same now, you know, it's just the cars have changed, and it's like, so it's like really kind of seeing a time machine by going there. I just think that's super cool. So
it is super cool. And I just like the feeling that everything just feels like it's all on top of each other. You know, the buildings are, even when there's no race, the buildings are right up to the edges of the road, and then the road, and then there's more buildings, and it's all kind of on a cliff all down to the harbor. And it's it's a beautiful place. And then you've got the old, you know, Prince's Palace up in old Monaco, which is its own sort of little world up there. It's just, it's an amazing place. I was there, I was in Monaco in 1999. That was the last time I was there.
Oh, that's right. You had the then and now picture too, didn't you?
Yeah. I was a poor backpacker, although I still felt poor this time, but I was a poor backpacking student, and I went not at all. I didn't even have any clue about the race then, but And so even since that, like, it honestly looks exactly the same.
That's so cool that can kind of withstand time in that way.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I was so excited. So this whole trip we did, the Monaco Grand Prix was one chunk of it, and then we did Corsica for five days after that. And so I was just excited the whole trip to shoot film, and I brought an array of cameras, but I tried to be strategic. And I also decided right away that I was not going to be the person with the long lens trying to get zoomed in shots of the cars. And there was a lot of those people, but I knew I don't have that equipment, and I didn't want to carry that equipment. And I didn't even really want those shots. I kind of wanted shots of the experience and from sitting in the stands. And so you were asking, you said you're not going to ask me how much it was, but like, it's the Monaco race ticket is so expensive. It's dumb.
I bet.
So much more than the other races, so much more. And so we decided, also because it's Monaco and qualifying is usually more exciting than the race, we decided to get tickets to qualifying.
Okay,
they were still expensive, but a lot less expensive. But we kind of paid for like the best seats. So we were sitting right in front of the casino, and the beautiful like Hotel de Paris was right there.
Yeah.
And the Mediterranean behind, and some of the yachts were going by. It was spectacular.
Well, and that casino's been in all kinds of movies, and you know what I mean? Like the Bond movies and stuff. And and that picture, that one picture you posted where the cars are coming at you and then they turn right, and then that's where they got to swerve over those big bumps and then go down by the Mirabeau, right? That 180. And so sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like, I just looking at where you're at, I'm like, oh, that's a good spot.
It was really awesome. And because, the cars are kind of, they have to slow down a bit to come down and do that little curve. And so that was my view. And so I just decided to capture it all rather than trying to zoom in. So, I brought five cameras on the trip, but I shot a lot of medium format, and I just, from 35, I just had a point and shoot. Cause I was like, I just also want this trip to not stress me out. I just want to enjoy it. I don't want to be thinking about whether or not, like, what my exposure should be. And, but I do want to capture it on film. I did want that experience. So
indulge me just a little bit. If you back up, so what cameras did you take? You said you had five cameras.
Okay. So I had, my little point and shoot was an Olympus stylus.
Okay.
I just like it. I can literally do everything in one hand. I can open the little door. I can press the shutter. I can close it again. I can turn on the
flash. That's awesome.
For my medium format, I took my Fuji GA645.
Nice.
So also very nice. My point and shoot medium format camera.
That's a good one though.
It takes perfect pictures every single time. It's the best camera. I love it so much.
That's cool.
I did take my Fuji digital camera, but I took a tiny little pancake lens on it. That's it.
Nice.
And then I had an Instax camera, and then I had a tiny like Digicam, like 2005 era.
Nice.
Waterproof digital camera that I thought, if it's raining or if I go swimming, I'll throw that in. So those were my cameras.
Nice. And the Instax was the digital one that can print it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Cause I remember you had posted a few things about that camera, and that's a kind of a cool camera. Cause some of us have the printer, but like in some ways that takes the friction right out of it because it's both in one package, right? You don't have to charge your phone to talk.
It was a funny choice in the end because I brought a bunch of film. I can talk about traveling with all the film I had too, but I brought packs of film. But with that camera, you actually, because it kind of is, it's a digital,
right?
It's a digital camera. Like, it's storing the images and you get to decide if you want to print it or not.
Right.
I didn't really need to bring the film. I could, and because in the end, I just mostly printed once I got home.
Okay.
And you can print photos from your phone if you want. And so it's a lot of flexibility. I like that camera. It's fun.
Okay.
I had 28 rolls of film with me. I didn't shoot it all. But I don't ever like to be worried that I'm going to run out. So it's okay.
No, look, if you're going to go somewhere that you don't know if you can buy film, you have to bring more than you think you'll need because we can't foresee the future exactly, right? You never know what's going to happen and you want to have the freedom. So this is exactly the way I think about it too. I'd rather take more with me. But I am curious though about traveling. So in Toronto, I've been to Toronto. Last time I was there, I think was in 2017, maybe 2016. 2016, 2017. And it was so funny though, because when I came back to the States, you're in Canada and you cross the gate and it says, you know, you are now in the United States and you have to go through United States custom. And it's like, okay, I'm pretty sure I'm in Canada. I mean, like, I understand the way governments work, but like, it was just kind of funny, but they were pretty good about it. They were like, for me, at least back then, but were they okay with you, in Toronto as far as like hand checking your stuff?
Yeah, I've never had a problem with hand checking in Toronto. They're always very accommodating. So we on this trip, we flew through 5 different airports because we had different. We were flying to.
Oh man.
We flew to Paris, and then we had to connect down to Nice. That was, I guess, all part of one. But and then we flew from Nice to Corsica, and Corsica, like, I don't know, we just had 5 different scanners. Man. Let's just say 5 scanner experiences. And the 2 I was most concerned about were the big airports. So I was worried about Toronto and I was worried about Charles de Gaulle on the way home.
Yeah.
Both of those hand checked. So I was
really.
And then 2 of the smaller airports, I think maybe I did have to put it through in Nice, but 2 of them just said, no, it's going through the scanner. But they were little airports and they were little scanners I've developed half the film now and it seems just fine, but those smaller scanners did have a little sticker on the outside with a, you know, like the picture of a canister of film with a check mark through it or something saying it's safe. You never know, but they didn't look scary. And they weren't going to check it for me.
Yeah.
Nothing I could do. But the 2 big airports, they hand checked. So I was happy about that.
That's cool, especially with the CT scanners, like the, you know, the old style, like square, you know, ones that the conveyor goes through. They're not terrible. Although the problem is radiation is a cumulative problem. Right. So it's you can make your joke about how much E. coli do you want in your hamburger? Right. So it's like really like none. My body can probably put up with some, but like where's the problem going to start?
Yeah.
And the other part is we never really know what happened to our film before we got it. Right. So you're always trying to avoid it. But yeah, the CT scanners will definitely screw it up. So that's my biggest fear is running into that, you know, on the one hand, CT scanner, and on the other hand, the I don't care, it's going in there. You know what I mean? Like, and you're powerless when you're going through security. I mean, what are you going to do? And it's so funny because I was in Germany in April and I only shot 2 rolls of 120. I brought like 6 or 7 with me. So I was, and that was more than I thought I needed it in the end. I only shot 2. But when I was coming back to the airport, I was like, will you hand check it? And they're like, oh, it should be fine. And it was so funny because the lady that comes over is this really pretty lady, but she's like got the hat on and the gun and all the stuff. And she's like, it'll be fine. And I'm like, well, if it's not, you don't care, do you? I'm like, it might not be. Could you please? You know what I mean? And she just looked, it kind of rolled her eyes at me. You know what I mean? Like I have a daughter who's in her 20s, right? So I mean, you know, it was like definitely a major eye roll situation, but they did it. They did it and they were nice about it. So, but yeah, I get that. But I think too, that sometimes we can get ourselves, or I won't say we, I can get myself worked up into a lather and it's like hard to and it's smart to just go, okay, that's what it is. That's what it is. We'll just see what happens. It'll probably be fine.
Yeah.
And
after the first time that it just went through, I said, there's nothing I can do now. And it's, through. And the other thing is I just try to make the process as easy as possible. So this time I took all the film out of its boxes and canisters and wrappers and made it super easy, because they will otherwise have to do that themselves. And that is annoying, especially if you have 28 rolls of film that are all still wrapped up. No regrets. I mean, so I think I shot 16 rolls on the 10 days we were away. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. That's so cool. Well, the ones that you posted so far that I've seen are awesome. It's really awesome. And of course you got one of those nice looks at the underbelly of the Mercedes, right? And because that was right where Hamilton crashed, wasn't it?
He crashed like just around the corner.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and it's amazing, those big cranes. I mean, those cranes are like as big as a building in height, you know what I mean? And they just like hoist them up and like you want to hear a funny little story?
Yes.
It's about Monaco and race cars. So there's the Porsche Cup. They had the Porsche Cup there, right? So there
we got stuck at an intersection because the Porsche Cup cars they had just finished their race and they were driving through just the regular streets of Monaco to get back to their parking lot. And so we saw the whole fleet by us. Yeah,
it
was cool.
So those cars, it's like a one make series, right? So all the cars are the same. So the whole idea is the team and the driver who gets the best out of the car is going to win the race, right? It's kind of like IROC if you go way back in the States, right? And I think the first International Race of Champions car was a Porsche, but then they settled on the Camaros for a long time. And they used to do it at NASCAR races. But anyhow, one of the funny things about sports car racing is the most damage a car usually gets. I mean, if it hits the wall, it's getting messed up. But a lot of times when they have a technical and pull over, when like the truck will come over and pull them up on the truck, they usually F the car up more than whatever the problem was that stopped it. And so they got to the point where they're like, we got to fix this. So they ended up welding these like little tubes inside the roll cage, and they made like this big bar that would hook into it, and then they would strap it up and you could just like lift the car with a crane and put, like you see in the Formula One races, right? Yeah. They put the strap through the roll hoop, they lift the car up and put it on. Well, for regular cars, this was something kind of new. And the funny part about it is the mechanism was like a little tube. And then there was a little rod, and there were these two little balls that would pop out that would hold that rod in the tube. And they were like, you should only lift the car, I don't know, 100 feet or something like that. You know, like there was some, the first year that it happened, it was in Monaco, a car broke, and one of those humongous cranes picked it up and it's like flying through the air. And you should have seen the people who like designed that thing that I happened to be lucky enough to be around them. They crap themselves and they're like, it's not supposed to be that. Not like they didn't think it wasn't going to work, but it was just like, holy God.
Oh my
So for the listeners, if you have no idea what we're talking about, I'm sorry. But yeah, if you ever look at any of the Monaco races, they're really cool because those huge cranes, they can reach it like a big area, right? I mean, they could be like a street away and come over and pick the car up.
I didn't expect to see those. I was initially kind of, you know, when you're taking a nice, you know, scenic shot and there's a ugly construction crane in the shot and you don't want it there. Initially I was like, but this is blocking my view of the casino and the Mediterranean. But then I realized, you know what they're for. Yeah. And then they actually got used. Not the one right in front of us, but the one around the corner got used. And so that was cool. And it was also really cool to see all the automobile club, like the Monaco Automobile Club.
Oh wow. Yeah, real slum, I'm sure.
They're all of the like safety crew for the whole race. So they're all in these orange jumpsuits.
Oh, sorry. So, I thought you meant actually cars, but you were talking about the people.
No, this is like, I actually don't know what their purpose is. I feel like they just.
Like the marshals or?
Yeah, like the marshals. But so
the guys waving the blue flag or like the yellow flags or whatever. Okay.
Hundreds of them. And they're in these bright orange jumpsuits. Mm-hmm. And so they look cool too. And I don't know, and it was cool because they're also fans. And so we would see them in the fan zone. Like they were there to see all the drivers when they were doing their you know, little promo stuff on stage, and they were excited too. So yeah, that was cool to see. Cause I mean, it's a big deal that it's not like they get races all year round. Like they wait for this.
Yeah. And I think they're volunteers too. I don't think they get paid. And I think one of like the best benefits of doing that, obviously being so close to the cars, but then for a photographer like you or me, I don't really think you can take your camera out. You know what I mean? Like, cause you're there to work.
I did not see anyone with a camera.
Right.
So I would volunteer if I got that orange jumpsuit. That would be.
But I think the two real benefits is like proximity, right? Yeah. If something happens. But then the other part is some scraps if there's an accident. Cause some of those, you know what I mean? When there's pieces laying on the ground, I mean, those are the guys and gals that run out there during the yellow flag or whatever and grab the pieces off the track or sweep up the track or do whatever it is that they need to do. But I'm sure that some of that stuff ends up going like right in the pocket, depending on how big it might be.
I had a cool, we had a cool experience. We were up on, we watched qualifying, we had tickets for qualifying day. And then on race day, we came into Monaco in the morning and then we were going a little bit out of town and we had a lunch reservation. We were going to watch the race at a restaurant and we ended up doing that. But in the morning we came into Monaco and we headed up to the old town, which is next to the Prince's Palace. And we actually ended up at this little cafe a couple of times that morning just because it was quiet and it seemed like the locals were hanging out there and they had good coffee. And
nice.
So our second time around that morning at the cafe, this older man was sitting next to us and he'd ordered a pizza and a pizza and a coffee, but maybe a pizza and a beer. I'm not sure. And he heard us talking and in English and I think asked us a question about, I don't know what he asked us, but turns out he's a lifelong Monegasque. Like he's lived in Monaco his whole life. He didn't speak French very well. He was mostly Italian. I kicked in my French. My French is pretty good.
Okay. But
he kept telling me, your French is better than my French. But we had this amazing conversation for probably half an hour just about living in Monaco. And he told us about the origins of how Monaco came to be and how he'd always dreamed of coming to Canada and all these, you know, just it was a really cool conversation. And then I was so proud of myself because I got up the courage at the end when we were leaving to ask him to take his portrait.
Nice.
Still to be developed, that one, but I did take a picture on my
awesome.
On my Fuji 645. So fingers crossed that one turns out. But that was just one of those cool traveling interactions that that happens. And I was like, I'm probably never gonna see him again. And let's just ask him.
Yeah.
To take his portrait. So that was cool.
That's really, really cool.
Yeah.
It's one of those moments too, where like that comes, cause I've only done it a few times myself, but it's always like, am I going to do this? Okay, do it. And it's like, you know what I mean? But then when you do, it's like, I'm so glad I did.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I did. So,
I mean, usually in my experience, most people's reaction is it's not no, it's mostly surprise. Like they wonder, why would you want to take a picture of me?
Yeah.
And that's easier to explain to me than like, or to them than, I don't know, trying to get upset that they said no, like that's ever happened to me, but it's more just, why do you want to take, what's so interesting about me? I think that's easy for me to get on board.
Exactly. Cause you already have all, genuine feelings about that. Right.
Yeah.
So like all you got to do is say what's in your head. That's the right thing. So it makes sense. That's cool. I love that finding locals too. Finding locals. My buddy and I.
We kept joking the whole week that we needed to find like our Monaco sugar daddy who could take us on, like as a family, adopt us. And I feel like that might have been our best bet, but it didn't really go anywhere beyond the portrait.
But someone that lived in Monaco their whole life, they're doing all right.
Yeah, he looked like he was doing all right. And his kids lived there too. And who knows?
Yeah.
He seemed kind of oblivious that the race was even happening that weekend. Like he was in a different echelon of society, I think.
I get it. No, that's so cool. That's I hope that that comes out and that you post it, because I'll be looking forward to seeing that. That sounds really, really awesome.
I will share it for sure. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you for coming on, Jess. It was really good talking to you. It's a blast. And you know what? I hope that everyone doesn't get too bummed that we talked about racing so much. But if they did, if that's the only bad thing you can say, then I think we can live with it. At least I can.
Maybe this is the start of like a series of crossover episodes. You just never know.
There'll be
secret fans that come out of the woodwork. You never know.
So two things that I want to say. So yeah, we mentioned Drive to Survive, right? That's the Netflix special, and there's been several seasons of that. So if you have any sort of interest in what we're talking about, if you check out one of those episodes, you might find it interesting. You might not. It's pretty high quality. I think they had the NFL Films people do it. Like I think they did a really nice job with it. So there's that. But then here's another one. From the pictures of your husband, of you and your husband together, I swear that guy looks like Roman Grosjean to me. The only bad part is that guy's such a bad driver. Like, I was afraid of saying that. I mean, he's the only guy that I think that ever drove through the Armco. Did you see that? Was it in like 21? You know, like the Armco is the rails on the side of the road around a mountain, right? It kind of looks like an S, or they'll call it a K rail or whatever, but there's usually like two sets of that steel.
Oh, was that the big crash, the fiery crash?
Yes. I mean, he hit that so hard that he went between those two steel pieces.
Yeah. That episode of the show was intense. You're right. Mark kind of does look like him.
It might've been the beard. Might have been the beard helped, you know, so he could pull it off. And you guys you should have played that up when you're in Monaco. You could have played that up. But it sounds like you had a great time. So that's really awesome. And thank you for sharing that with us, especially as like kind of a voyeur. I've only seen the race from TV, right? So it's more like looking inside out, or you're looking outside in. I don't know. Maybe I'm looking inside outside in and you're looking inside out, but you know what I mean? Like, what you see from what you saw is like so different than, or like, what was it? The one Iron Man movie when he was sitting in the Raskas cafe, I think. Right. Like, you know, where they make that U-turn. Right. And they were like right there. It was like, I mean, as soon as I saw it, like even out the window, I was like, holy crap, I know exactly where that is, you know? But so like that sort of experience they had is really awesome.
It did feel like we were on a movie set or something. And it felt like you could almost, this is a weird thing to say, but it did feel, you could feel like anyone who's watching the race, it's like you could feel them watching Monaco that weekend. Like, it's just such a, it's not very big. I think it has the lowest attendance. Smallest attendance, just because it's such a small place.
Yeah.
And it just becomes the entire place. And it was very special. And I said going into it, this is a once in a lifetime trip, but now all I want to do is go back.
So awesome. And I think it's great. You had a picture of yourself there, even if it was unconnected to the race from, you know, many years ago, and
then
one today. And that's super cool. That's super, super cool. And all on analog. So, all right. So, well, thank you, Jess. We really appreciate you coming on. And Oh, you want to do the tag? You want to do the ending line?
Oh, I don't know the ending line.
I did a bad job. I'm a bad host. This is the first time I felt like I was actually interviewing someone. I don't really think it was an interview. We were having a discussion about something we liked, right? But
tag team it, if you say the first part, I will remember the second part.
Everybody stay positive and
shoot some cool film photos.
Yeah, that's it. You nailed it.
So, got it.
And I didn't even prep you for that. So I let you down. And all worried. I'm like, I want to do a good job as a host. And I don't know.
Did a great job. This is so fun. Say hi to your other co-captains.
I will, definitely. And we'll look forward to having you back on sometime.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jess. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Negative Positives Podcast. I'm Mike Kukovica, otherwise known as Kooks, and you can see me on Instagram at The Drunk Darkroom. You can email this program at negpositives@gmail.com. That's negpositives@gmail.com. You can join our Facebook group at the Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group. We also have an Instagram account under the account name Negative Positives. If you submit photos to Instagram, think about using the hashtag Negative Positives. You can support this podcast on Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/negativepositives.
Gutter Man Cave Production!